It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the potential harm to endangered species through crop acreage devoted to corn. That's a popular feedstock for producing ethanol, which is a renewable fuel. Call in with questions and comments about biofuel and biofuel crops. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tyler Lark is a lead scientist at the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment at UW-Madison. His new policy analysis is in the journal Biological Conservation. Tyler, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Well, lay it out for us. How is the mass production of ethanol affecting sensitive habitats?
Well, the connection is sort of just as you'd imagine. When we increase demand for ethanol and a product that uses a lot of corn, our landscapes, our farmers respond. We meet that need. We plant more corn, but oftentimes that comes at the cost of habitat. And so it's not really surprising that there's an interaction here. And what we want to do is just be cognizant of that and see if there's ways that where we can mitigate that potential harm.
And is the corn crop the primary issue here, or are there other biofuel crops contributing to the problem?
Yeah, right now, the way this policy is set up, it's the federal renewable fuel standard. Corn ethanol is really the number one biofuel that we produce. And so pretty much everything is coming from corn. And there's calls and interest in shifting away towards more advanced renewable biofuels. But right now it's predominantly corn.
And how much corn does it take to make ethanol? How much of that crop is really contributing to the ethanol industry, if you will?
Well, it's a big piece of agriculture, and our corn crop right now covers anywhere from 80 to 90 million acres of land across the country, and somewhere in the range of 25 to 40% of that gets used for fuel ethanol each year.
Turning to wildlife and species, which endangered species are particularly vulnerable to ethanol production?
Well, there's a whole bunch, a few that we looked at for this study. It really runs the gamut, things from small insects and pollinators up to larger birds and mammals as well as something we often don't think about as aquatic species, things that rely on clean and clear water that might be impacted by nutrient pollution, for example.
Oh, like in the Gulf of Mexico, for instance.
Yeah, right. So we know a lot of our fertilizer that we apply to our farmlands and that we need to produce this food. Unfortunately, we lose a lot of it to the environment as well, and it runs downstream and eventually ends up, if not deposited somewhere else, in the Gulf of Mexico.
So as these lands turn over to corn, it means that wildlife have less and less habitat to be able to live. Is that the primary concern here?
Yeah, so anytime we're expanding production of a single crop, so say corn in this example, there's kind of two ways to do that. We can either switch other crops to corn, so that would be, you know, growing less wheat in Wisconsin, growing less alfalfa, a really valuable crop for our dairy herd, and planting more corn. And in that case, corn is just often a really intensive crop. It requires a lot of fertilizer, and the production and application of that fertilizer results in a lot of greenhouse gas or carbon pollution. And on the other side, you can get more corn by bringing more land into production. And oftentimes that comes at the cost of things like perennial grass pasture that may have been used for grazing or other types of conservation grasslands.
Which is where you bring in, for instance, butterflies and whooping cranes. What are you finding when that lack of habitat isn't there? What connection can you make that it is having an impact?
Yeah, all sorts of potential pathways here. So it's not hard to imagine a bird species or an insect, say a pollinator, something like the rusty patch bumblebee, something found right here in Wisconsin, that needs some of these floral resources, so the nectar, the pollen, to survive as a food source. And those usually come in locations of grasslands or, you know, open fields where there's a diverse mixture of plant species growing and flowering plants that they need. And when you replace that with, say, a monoculture crop, and particularly one that doesn't have a lot of diverse plant life within its boundaries often, that just reduces those resources that a lot of these species rely on.
We're looking at the impact of ethanol production and particularly the impact on wildlife. UW-Madison scientist Tyler Lark, our guide. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. So turning to the renewable fuel standard, Congress establishes it in 2005, expands it in 2007, and this mandate that all transportation fuel must include a minimum volume of renewable fuel. What environmental concerns is this standard meant to address?
Well, initially, I think it came at a time, you know, about 15 years ago when there's a lot of concerns about energy independence, right? So a heavy reliance on petroleum and oil products from the Middle East and elsewhere. And it's still a case, right? We need to move away from petroleum-based and fossil fuels as soon as possible. And you know, nothing about corn ethanol says that we should continue with fossil fuels. But we want to be thoughtful about how we shift away and do that in the best way possible. And so that's where these renewable fuels come in and where this policy came in both in advancing energy independence, but I think the goal was also to try to get some environmental benefits. And we've just seen over the course of the 15 years that it's played out, a lot of the land use changes that can come with the additional need to produce all this extra corn for one single crop and one single fuel had a lot of environmental side effects. And so if there are ways to mitigate those, I think that's the direction that we really want to move going forwards.
A farm is a business, and it to me is conceivable that the farmer grows the highest value crop in response to market prices. They have to make choices that make economic sense as well. How is the renewable fuel standard affecting those decisions, perhaps with implications on wildlife conservation and other environmental pressures?
I think it's playing a big role, and you bring up a great point that it's definitely not, you know, it's not the consumers at the pump who are choosing one blend of fuel over the others, and it's definitely not our farmers who are managing and stewarding our lands and the landscape. Often it's the policies, right? And so the policy in this case, this renewable fuel or federal ethanol mandate, is driving these decisions. And so we've seen through our research that it increases the price of crops, especially corn, but other crops as well. And that then drives these changes that we can observe on the landscape.
Putting two agencies together here, the Environmental Protection Agency implements the renewable fuel standard. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service entrusted to protect animals listed as endangered. Do these agencies collaborate on regulating biofuel production?
Right now, I think not to the extent that they could. So there's been, my understanding, some initial discussions. And really what this research says is, hey, there's a lot of potential for interaction here and a lot of opportunity. So if we pull these experts in, folks from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service who study and know and understand these imperiled wildlife and wildlife at large, can we modify this fuel policy that's implemented by the EPA and do so in a way that we can meet, you know, our energy production goals while doing it without jeopardizing or compromising the environment?
We have scientist Tyler Lark, studies land use at UW-Madison Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment, as we take a closer look at ethanol production and corn crops. Call in with your questions, your comments about corn-based ethanol, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we examine corn ethanol production, biofuels policy, and potential harmful impacts to wildlife conservation. A new journal article finds limited research in this area offers some solutions we'll get into. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tyler Lark is lead scientist at the Global Land Use and Environment Laboratory of UW-Madison. Let's bring in Bill in Barnes. Bill, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Good morning. So we're putting corn in our gas tanks because it's better than oil. But when you consider all the energy inputs to produce that ethanol of fuel to run the tractors, to apply the herbicides, to manufacture the herbicides, to dry the grain, to distill it into alcohol. When the total system of energy inputs is considered, what's the net gain of us essentially putting corn in our gas tank?
Bill, thanks for that question, Tyler.
That's a really good question, and a question people have been looking at now for quite some time, especially that we've upped our investment in ethanol. And all those things, as you mentioned, contribute to this overall climate pollution profile or greenhouse gas emission profile of the fuel. And at the end of the day, when you include all those, it comes out a lot closer than we think. So there's a lot of variance depending on where you grow it and how you grow it. Some studies say corn ethanol is 20% better. Others say it's 20% worse as far as greenhouse gas emissions relative to gasoline. And so, you know, it's sort of a wash there. And that's where I think we have to think about if we're going to have a lot of this fuel, we want to do it in a way that's not also degrading our environment in other dimensions.
Let's look at reducing harm, focusing on potential solutions. What practices would help reduce harm to nearby wildlife?
Yeah, so the great thing is we have a whole set of tools available right now that can help address this. And so conservation agricultural practices, if we're thinking about water quality and we want to have, you know, clean, clear water for habitat for wildlife and for us as humans as a species as well, practices like putting cover crops on our fields or using conservation tillage practices, things that will reduce the amount of runoff and erosion and contributions to water impairment is a great easy first step and something that a lot of farmers are already familiar with and know how to do. And so just tying some of those conservation practices to these mandates and other incentives and policies that are in place could go a long ways in reducing some of the environmental impacts.
What about like timing the harvest so it might occur outside a sensitive wildlife nesting season?
Yep, that could be another one, especially as we look towards some of these more advanced biofuels that might be, you can imagine something if we could create a fuel from a native and a perennial grassland and harvest that grass rather than having to plant intensive rows of corn and fertilize it really intensively. There's a lot of potential and excitement there, and you could also manage it in a way that provided great nesting and breeding habitat for these threatened and endangered species, while also providing a really productive product for society and for farmers as well.
And so that might be like a second and third generation fuel, whereas corn and soybeans would be a first generation biofuel?
Yep, exactly.
Okay, let's take another call now. Charlie with us in Beaver Dam. Charlie, what's on your mind?
I'm just saying about land use there on Highway 175 and 49. They're taking over 400 acres and putting it into solar panels. Highway B, just outside of Beaver Dam, they're taking hundreds of acres and putting it into solar panels. It's perfectly good farmland, and then they're taking it and putting solar panels. I was told the one on B is a 50-year lease. So that means that land's going to be out of production for a minimum of 50 years.
Charlie, thank you for that observation and the role of solar farms here. What impact that can have to not only crop rotations but to wildlife, Tyler?
Charlie brings up a great point. And so our farmers right now and our land managers are feeling pressures from all sorts of dimensions, right? We have continued urban sprawl and development. We have alternative and renewable energy sources like solar photovoltaic systems that we want to get up. And so they're feeling the crunch from all sides. And so just like with renewable fuels and corn ethanol, we want to be thoughtful, I think, in how we site things like solar panels. And so there's emerging concepts, this idea of agrivoltaics. Can we integrate those solar panels on our landscape in a way that they're not going on our prime farmland, but maybe they're, you know, working on the marginal lands that are a little bit less productive and perhaps even integrated with agricultural production? So you can envision maybe grazing sheep underneath the solar panels or intermixing them with crops in a way that was co-beneficial for temperature regulation or water conservation. And so I think actually that solar panel and the expansion of solar production is a huge opportunity, but we, just like with renewable fuels, we want to do it thoughtfully and with some reflection and doing it in a way that can support farmers and our agricultural industry rather than really squeeze them out, which, you know, can be the case in sometimes.
I hear hints of what of being intentional about what we do to these lands and real dual purpose in ensuring a crop can do multiple things and have multiple benefits. Is that where you really would like to push the research?
I think you just put it in words better than I could myself. Yeah, dual purpose, right? Agriculture, we get a lot from it. It's really valuable for production, for society, and for food production in particular for us. But we can also ask more of it and get conservation benefits out of it, or renewable energy production out of it, whether it be through solar or other types of biofuels.
Suburban sprawl, also such an issue, you know, transforming large plots of undeveloped land and putting a crunch on wildlife habitats. How much attention should also be paid by city planners to the conservation of wildlife areas as these developments go in?
Well, we have, yeah, really one single land base, right? They always, the old adage is they're not making any more of it. We're not getting any more land. And so I think it's from all directions. It's at the urban fringe is a really important place to be thoughtful and think about, do we want to have these large sprawling subdivisions or large lot types of housing developments where you have to mow 5 acres of lawn? Or do we want to do it a little bit more densely and efficiently, which also then opens up opportunities for, you know, improved transit and mass transit and reduces the needs for fuels. So it all almost ties together in that sense of having, you know, smart growth in the urban areas and the urban fringe with smart land use in our rural landscapes of how we use our farmland for food and energy production.
Learning about food and energy production and the impact of ethanol production in the mix with UW-Madison scientist Tyler Lark. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Returning now to the renewable fuel standard, a bit more policy here. Last year, we saw the Center for Biological Diversity suing the EPA over its implementation of the renewable fuel standard. And the conservation group says the federal agency has failed to assess how endangered species are impacted. How could, you know, be a solution coming out of the legal back and forth and the litigation?
Yeah, well, I think that probably plays a pretty important role. What it does is that I think it helps us dedicate resources to this. So it says, there's something going on here. This is an issue that we care about as society. These two policies, the Renewable Fuel Standard and the Endangered Species Act, are both two huge policies that have huge impacts on our landscapes and our livelihoods. And so getting those experts together in a room, the ones who know each of those policies intricately and say, how can these work together in a mutually beneficial way, I think only good can come of that. And so that's really what our research here that we're talking about today did, and that's what I think some of these legal questions and challenges that have come up are also trying to work towards.
There is this bipartisan group of Midwest governors and fuel industry leaders who are pushing the government to approve higher ethanol sales this summer. What do you make of that idea, and what is the impact of that on the environment?
Well, the research out there kind of suggests that really if that or any policy increases demand, specifically if we were to say for U.S. corn ethanol, then it's likely that we're going to respond and bring additional land into corn production. And so we know that that then comes along with some of those additional carbon emissions and conversion of wildlife. And so if it increases demand for ethanol, that's the likely outcome. If it just sort of maintains it because there's a declining share of fuel use elsewhere, then the impacts probably aren't as severe.
I need to pick your brain about this. What happens to all this ethanol with EVs that are set to take over the road in the coming years, in the coming decades?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's going to be a slow ramp up probably, and there's always going to be some hard to electrify sectors. If we think of air travel or shipping overseas, or even heavy-duty trucking in some cases. So there's probably a role for liquid transportation fuels for a while going forwards. And I think the question is, what proportion of that liquid fuel supply do we want coming from ethanol? And perhaps it will ramp up as gasoline ramps down and sort of replace it. I think an ideal situation would be it ramps up, but with better biofuels, ones that are more friendly on our landscapes, you know, based off of perennial and native plants. And yeah, it continues to probably be a part of that mixture. But as you say, as electric vehicles and more renewable fuels come online, or more renewable ways to produce that electricity come online, it'll continue to be a complement. And we just want to sort of balance that in the best way possible.
It's a balance. Tyler, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Tyler Lark, lead scientist at the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment at UW-Madison. We have a link to his policy analysis at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, warns raw milk can carry harmful germs that may pose serious health risks. We explore the consumption of raw dairy, why it's a hot-button issue in states like Wisconsin, where dairy is big business. Join this discussion on raw dairy anytime. Your questions, your experiences, 800-642-1234. Food science professor John Lucey directs the UW-Madison Center for Dairy Research, stays with us. And Rob Rollier is a senior extension associate in the Department of Food Science at Cornell University, managing dairy extension programs in New York State, specializing in cheese and artisan cheese production and safety. Rob, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
Well, let's start with, you know, you being involved with helping dairy farmers understand regulations and food safety in your state. How are New York laws different from other states' laws regarding raw dairy?
Well, that's a great question. I deal a lot with raw milk farmers and raw milk cheese producers in New York State. The New York regulations allow raw milk sales on the farms. And they allow raw milk production, obviously, if it's aged 60 days, which is the federal limit. But I also deal with issues when people have outbreaks and things like that, or they have hot hits on their milk or on their cheeses, which we'll talk about probably later. But I help them, you know, try to understand what the risks are. I try to help them understand what they need to do to make sure that they don't have problems. And our state actually does inspections on these farms, and they're issued a license. So they're inspected every 90 days at the farm level. So we have state inspectors go into the farm and make sure that they're maintaining cleanliness and those types of things. And then they also take samples of the milk and they test them for pathogens. They have a specific pathogen screen. They're testing for four different pathogens currently. And that's done on a quarterly basis. So, we have about 35 to 40 farms that sell raw milk in New York State currently.
Okay. I'm going to bring in a comment here from Eric in Milwaukee. Got raw milk from a friend to make cheese, and Eric tried it and said it tasted great, but they got Campylobacter, the infection, and Eric missed a week of work and said once the doctors found out what it was, it took one pill to fix. What are some of the symptoms and illnesses that can be caused by consuming raw milk, Rob?
Campylobacter is probably the number one cause of illness from raw milk consumption. It's estimated with a lot of the studies that I've seen, including some that are done at Cornell, they found as much as 70% of raw milk can be contaminated with low levels of Campylobacter. The problem with Campylobacter is it can always have what we call long-term chronic sequelae, which basically amounts to you get sick from Campylobacter, but then your body has a reaction maybe 6 months to a year later, where it's called what they call Guillain-Barré syndrome. And it's basically, it basically paralyzes you. Mm. It can be permanent or it can go away on occasion. And it rarely happens. I mean, maybe 5 to 10% of people that actually get it have that occur, but it's something that can occur. It's just like people can get E. coli from milk, for example. That's another one that generally affects small kids the worst, because once you have E. coli, Many of these kids develop hemolytic uremic syndrome and wind up being on dialysis for the rest of their life. So it can be a lifetime event if you get the right disease. Other things that you can get from raw milk consumption include salmonella. You could get strep infections. You can get staph infections, staph toxin poisoning, depending on the level of staph, which is a mastitis organism. So it's naturally found in raw milk. You could get brucellosis, which has kind of gone away, but not totally in that, you know, our herd health regulations have helped eliminate brucellosis and tuberculosis.
And I want to pause right there on brucellosis and bring in John Lucy as well here. John, we heard from Louise in Viroqua called and is curious about cattle brucellosis. Louise grew up on a dairy farm and someone said, you know, they got Bang's disease, which I understand it's also been called supposedly from drinking raw milk. And what can you tell us about that?
Well, historically, a large proportion of food-related diseases that were contracted by humans came from the consumption of milk from cows or close contact from cows or cattle. And brucellosis, tuberculosis were part of that. So I think we, as Rob mentioned, you know, we have done a great job here from the cattle side of things. We're trying to eliminate some diseases or reduce the incidence of it, but those are still a risk for contracting them from the consumption of raw milk. We're fortunate that when we look at pasteurization, it's targeted to destroy the most heat-stable pathogen that's present in the milk. So we're always looking at that and saying, what is another potential one out there that could be a risk to us? And let's make sure the heat treatment is killing enough. So I think, you know, overseas, that's still a factor, you know, in some countries because the cattle are in many parts of the world endemic for both brucellosis and tuberculosis.
Rob, you said you've seen a waning of brucellosis. What might be causing that?
Well, the animal herd health regulations that they've put in place across the country really have helped to eliminate that. The other piece of the puzzle was in the early 1900s when pasteurization starting to become widespread. The initial regulations were targeting tuberculosis because that was the organism that we thought at the time, well, they didn't think it was at the time, the most heat resistant that was transmissible from milk to humans. But we've since found Coxiella burnetti as being more heat resistant. So now that's the target organism. So that's another organism that causes Q fever that's transmissible from milk to humans. I gave you a short list of organisms and diseases that can come from drinking raw milk. There's many, many more, but that just gives you an idea.
Rob, we haven't talked about pregnant people. Why should pregnant people absolutely stay away from raw milk products?
Well, that's a huge concern because Listeria is an organism that's found in raw milk as well on occasion. It's also on occasion a mastitis organism that will show up in cows, but they won't really show signs of infection. So it's kind of a low-grade infection of the udder. And if a pregnant woman ingests Listeria, it can actually go through cellular membranes and into the placenta and cause the fetus to get sick. And we all know that it's hard enough coming out into the world being healthy. How would you like to do it being sick at the same time?
We are looking at the risks of raw milk consumption, the debate over raw milk. John Lucy and Rob Rollier. John is director of the Center for Dairy Research at UW-Madison. Rob, senior extension associate in the Department of Food Science at Cornell. You can join in along the way, 800-642-1234. Lee is here from Madison. Lee, what are you going to bring up?
Hi, thanks for my call. God, we grew up on the farm drinking raw milk. Go up for breakfast and bring milk with us. I don't know why all the problems are today, but there is consumer pasteurizers you can use to pasteurize the milk that are convenient.
Have you used consumer grade pasteurizers, Lee? I think we've lost him. John, can you help us out there on consumer grade pasteurizers? What do you know?
Well, I think there's a lot of over the years, especially as people started to get more aware of the risks of what could be in raw milk, there was a lot of different devices that people were sold that they could heat or boil their milk for heat treating it rather than drinking it raw. And one of the things that fascinates me is, you know, in Europe, they have vending machines for raw milk. In a place like Italy, I think a number of years ago, they had over 1,000 of these vending machines to allow access for raw milk to the public at various locations. But after some of the diseases that Rob was mentioning, including the hemolytic uric syndrome, that children, it's a serious condition for children, they now put stickers on, in Italy, they put stickers in all of those vending machines saying, please boil. And at farms too, it's very typical at farms, they either drink the raw milk, as we've been discussing this morning, or as they get more concerned about maybe something being in their milk, that they're boiling it. And that's usually a much more higher and aggressive heat treatment than the very short time and temperature that we're talking about from your regular pasteurized jug.
Have an email here from Grant, wants to know, Rob, the regulations about raw milk going into artisan cheese, and is it legal, and what should Grant be watching out for?
Well, the milk going into raw cheese is legal, yes. They've passed they're required to do antibiotic testing, which the raw milk farms in New York currently are not. So every dairy plant in the country has to test the truckload that's coming in for antibiotics. They screen for what are called beta lactams, which are the most commonly used antibiotics at the farm level on cattle. So if a truck is positive for antibiotics, they have to dispose of that. They can't use it in a dairy plant. The farms that sell raw milk and that are not testing for antibiotics at all. So you could go to a farm, it could be a very clean farm, and they might have tested a cow or treated a cow with antibiotics, put it in the tank. Now you're going to get parts per million of a beta lactam, for example. The raw milk cheese people are required to test for antibiotics before they put it into their raw milk cheese. There is literature out there that shows that raw milk cheese aged 60 days doesn't always necessarily kill pathogens. And I can tell you from experience and a lot of it that, and even in New York, because raw milk cheese is tested for pathogens on a regular basis by the state, we do find positive hits for Listeria and E. coli.
And in New York, what goes into a farm that gets a state license to sell direct to consumer on the farm? What does that state license entail?
Well, they have to maintain a clean farm, obviously clean to the, you know, and a regulatory standard is the lowest standard possible. So if you have a very clean farm, obviously you're going above and beyond, but there's a minimum cleanliness that they inspect for. They're also going to have to test for pathogens. The state actually does that every quarter, but to start your farm up, you have to test for pathogens. And I think you have to get two tests that are completely negative before they'll issue the permit. And then they have to have a sign, as John alluded to, that says that raw milk doesn't offer the same protection as pasteurization on the farm. And then they basically can start selling milk to the public.
John, do you hear anything there, New York's path with their license?
Well, I think that's pretty typical for a lot of states where they go through some sort of, you know, inspection, testing process. I want to come back to one of the comments that Rob is talking about. The raw milk for cheese, you know, that's what we call a 60-day rule, which means you can't sell it for 60 days, was originally developed from studies that were done on cheddar cheese, which is a very different product from maybe some of the artisan cheeses that might be produced. So any cheese that is high in pH, a soft cheese, for example, that is a much more significant risk to the public than your cheddar cheese. Why? because there are pathogens that will literally grow while you're storing the cheese. So storing it for 60 days is not any protection at all. In fact, it increases the risk that there's more contamination in it. And when you look at outbreaks from CDC data, a lot of the outbreaks are coming from raw milk cheeses rather than raw milk itself.
John Lucy is a professor of food science, director of the Center for Dairy Research at UW-Madison. Cornell University's Rob Rollier manages dairy extension programs across New York State. Still time to call with your questions about raw dairy. Share your views on this debate, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore raw milk cheeses and what to know about the consuming of unpasteurized dairy. Still time to ask your question. Your call's welcome at 800-642-1234. Rob Rollier is here, Senior Extension Associate in the Department of Food Science at Cornell University. And we also have UW-Madison Food Science Professor John Lucy, who leads the Center for Dairy Research. They stay with us. John, you have mentioned, brought up the CDC a number of times here. I'm wondering, when you look at that CDC data, do more outbreaks related to raw dairy happen in states where it is legal to sell it?
Yes, that's correct, Kate. The funny thing about it, too, is you look through some of the data, even in states, if you look at over the last 20 years and the studies they've done, even in states where raw milk was illegal, there are outbreaks related to raw milk consumption. So what it means is that not everybody is following the rules, even in states where it's illegal, as we well know. But yes, you are correct. And that's the kind of concerning thing for me as we think about expanding access to raw milk, is that will increase the amount of outbreaks, the number of hospitalizations, and unfortunately, the likelihood of several deaths as well.
Rob Rollier, is there a way to sell and consume raw milk products safely?
Yeah, you can pasteurize it. I mean, there are other methods, but there's nothing that's approved. Like high pressure processing is being worked on to look at what it does to milk, and maybe that's going to be a method of the future, but it's currently not an approved method for pasteurization. You're on a farm, so milk comes from a cow, and the bottom end of the cow is closest to the manure pit, and there's just no way around that. That's just the nature of the beast. And so I'm a person that really advocates pasteurization, because most of the people that get sick from raw milk outbreaks are generally small kids. Matter of fact, the CDC that John's talking about, they did a study in 1998 that encompassed about 20 years, and about over half of those outbreaks, at least one kid that was under five, it's going to vary by the size of the outbreak, obviously, was included in the outbreak. And people say, well, these people that I'm selling milk to are my friends. Well, nobody's your friend when their kid is now sick and it's been attributed back to your product. And that's the scariest part. And the other issue you run into is legality. Is your farm insurance cover you selling a raw milk product? We have some litigation going on in New York, as a matter of fact. One was going to a criminal trial. I don't know how it's turned out, if they went to the grand jury yet or not, but this person made a raw milk cheese, and two people across state lines died from it. And it's a federal offense. They were going to take him to federal court, and they were going to criminally charge him. So there's that aspect of it, too.
I haven't thought about the insurance riders on raw dairy. Let's go to Karen in Galena. Karen, what would you like to bring up?
I'm wondering if salmonella poisoning can have long-term effects on the kidney, the GFR rates, similar to the E. coli that can also be caused by raw milk.
Karen, thank you. Rob, can you field that?
That's a little bit out of my area of expertise.
Out of your wheelhouse. Okay.
Yeah, I missed that week of medical school. but it wouldn't surprise me if the answer is yes, because everybody reacts differently to certain things. And I know Campylobacter is one for sure that can cause long-term issues. Obviously, E. coli, we already know that. But Salmonella, it wouldn't surprise me either. Generally, E. coli is a little bit more aggressive in creating problems in the intestine in terms of damage overall. But Salmonella wouldn't surprise me. John might have more insight on that.
Anything else there, John?
No, I think Rob has covered it well. I think, you know, some of this comes down to two kind of questions for me when we think about all of these topics. One, are there pathogens likely to be present in raw milk? And the answer there is a very definitely yes. We can argue about the percentage of it in there, what types, but very definitely from every study done from New Zealand to Europe to the US is because of what Rob mentioned, the farms themselves are a reservoir of pathogens and the cows and cattle themselves are a reservoir. That means they have it in their GI tract and it's in the soil and water. So there's nothing we can ever do to stop farms and cattle having pathogens. It's whether they get into the milk. The second question that comes up for me is, why would we want to take that risk, especially for kids or pregnant women or somebody who has more of a heightened risk? Is there a nutritional benefit from consuming the raw milk? And about 7 reviews have been done over the last 10 or 15 years, and none of them have found any nutritional benefit from consuming raw milk. So I go look at that, and at that point, I'm going like, well, there is the chance that raw milk is in there. Yes, if you grew up on a farm and you're used to drinking raw milk, you're probably a little bit more conditioned to it than the general public. But the fraction of people living on farms now in the US is tiny compared to what it was 20, 30, 50 years ago. So that's the kind of situation that I look at right now.
Very quickly, as we're out of time, Rob, do you see states expanding their policy, making it legal or illegal? Is there movement around the country on this?
Well, there's always movement. I know Missouri's considering it now as well, and there are probably a few other states. A lot of times it'll get into a committee, like an agricultural committee in one of the state houses, and they'll talk about it, they'll pass it. But when it gets to the mainstream to get to the governor's signature, it falls down. And it's really more a mechanism of the fringe on either side trying to figure out, you know, well, we want this to pass. So they talk to their congressman, and then the other side says, well, it's a public health issue and we don't want it to pass. And then that's where the fight really starts.
Well, thank you both for bringing clarity on this. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you.
John Lucey, professor of food science and the director of the Center for Dairy Research at UW-Madison. Rob Rollier, senior extension associate in the Department of Food Science at Cornell University. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.